Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. This is CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus in Vancouver. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are speaking with Lisa Smart. She's the author of Words at the Threshold. Lisa is a linguist, educator, and poet. She founded the Final Words Project, which is an ongoing study devoted to collecting and interpreting the mysterious language at the end of lives. She co-facilitates workshops about language and consciousness with Raymond Moody at universities, hospices, and conferences. And you can find her at finalwordsproject.org. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us. So I believe this project kind of came to life through your experience with your father's passing. But can you tell us a little bit about how you were inspired to do this?
Well, my degree is in linguistics, and I love language. I've always been intrigued by how language reveals who we are and our view of the world. You know, the words we choose often say so much about who we are. And so I have always loved language and received my degree in that. And in the last 3 weeks of my father's life, I spent much time with him. And in those last 3 weeks, I was very aware of the changes that went on in the words he spoke. And not just in the words that I heard, but also in what his perceptions were. So my father was a skeptic, very rational, very bright man who never believed in anything like angels or a world beyond this one in any way. And yet in those last 3 weeks, I just began writing down everything he said. And among the things that I tracked was his descriptions of angels and interesting landscapes. And as a matter of fact, 3 days before he died, he said to me, 3 days left, 3 days left. The angels say only 3 days left. And 3 days later, he was gone.
Wow.
So just seeing and hearing what I heard from my father, and as I mentioned, because I was trained in linguistics, very early on I noticed significant changes in his language. I just began writing everything down. That's what I was trained to do when I heard language that intrigued me. And by the time that he passed away, I had several pages of words that he had spoken, and many of them intrigued me because they were very different than the kind of language I heard from him throughout my life. And that's how my curiosity about final words began.
Wow. So Lisa, when you say that you noticed a change in his language, can you say more about that?
Well, you know, my father was a very, very rational man, very lucid. And in those last 3 weeks, he started speaking almost as if he was living in a dream. And well, first of all, as I mentioned, the angels, but then he started talking about a green dimension. And he talked about this big art show that was approaching, when indeed there was absolutely no art show. But my mother was an artist. And throughout their lives together, he would carry boxes to her art shows. So he made this big announcement about this upcoming art show and how he had to bring boxes, but there were no boxes and there was no art show, but it seemed I was intrigued by that. And he wasn't on very heavy medication. And so I would notice he would talk about this art show or these other kinds of symbols that he referred to throughout those weeks. And he, it seemed like, well, the time I thought, maybe it's the medication, or is it the illness that he's confronting, which was at the time prostate cancer. But then he would move in and out of lucidity, right? And then suddenly he would be very lucid. And then I noticed that he was saying things like, help me down from here, when he was lying on the bed, as if he were moving around in space and time. And he would talk about, he would talk sort of what's called non-referential language. So, for example, he said to his secretary a few days before he died, oh, Alice, this is very interesting. I've never done this before. And I was intrigued by the this. He often referred to this. And I thought, well, why doesn't he talk about dying? Why is he using this? And then there was all kind of nonsense. Like he said, my modality is broken. My modality is broken. And I thought, modality? Modalities don't break. What is going on in the mind of my father in these last days? And so that was part of what intrigued me. And I just wrote everything down and began to try to analyze the patterns that I heard.
So Lisa, were you able to ask him about these things? And you mentioned that there were periods when he was very lucid. So I would imagine his language was different in those periods than when he was talking about art shows and modalities.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I think one of the things that happened to me, which I think may happen to others, is when someone you love is dying, there's a sort of emotional, at least for me, I was in despair. My father, who I love very much, was dying. And in some ways, I wasn't clear-headed. And also, there was a kind of a separation. I think there's such a taboo about speaking to the dying, right? So when these things came up, I almost felt like I didn't know how to talk to him about what was going on because I was so scared to address the reality of what was before me. And I really regret that. I wished I had said, oh, Daddy, tell me more about your broken modality. And I think that's part of what I learned from doing this research and what I say to others is there were so many conversations I was afraid to have because I was so frightened by and baffled by the language I heard. And I wish now that I said to my dad, ooh, Daddy, tell me about the angels, or ooh, you know, tell me more about the big art show. And because I was so afraid of death and dying and so, I guess I could say, taken aback or kind of stunned that my father, who had always been so clear in his language, suddenly everything had changed. And I actually just, all I knew how to do at the time was to write the words down. But I was too afraid, really, or stunned, or, I don't know, ill-prepared to really enter into the conversations now I wish I had had.
Fair enough. I mean, I think we all have those regrets after someone we love passes, all the things that could have been said if only we'd known better at the time.
Yeah. Yes. And I think the gift of it too, and we did have conversations, you know, it's not that it was all like that, but I think that when you'd asked, you know, about getting into conversation with him, you know, I did to some degree, of course. It's not that I was just, you know, frozen in terror or, you know, I didn't know what to say. But there were so many things that passed by without my speaking or addressing him. And that's why when he died, and then there were the conversations like, hey, Papa, you know, that were very lucid. You know, he said, make sure my granddaughter gets guitar lessons. And he asked me to cook him his favorite pot roast a few days before he died. You know, so there were a lot of very lucid conversations, but he moved in and out of those. And when he moved out of those lucid moments, and they weren't associated with any medication or anything, but he would move out of those lucid moments. I think I just was baffled and didn't know what to say. And so that's part of what compelled me to do this research. And the question I had is everyone like this? You know, does everyone move in and out of these lucid moments? What's going on? And does everyone see angels? Or was it just something unique to my father? So in some ways, some of the difficulties I faced and the challenges I faced were actually, in a sense, a gift because they led me to want to know more.
Thanks, Lisa. Right now, we are speaking with Lisa Smart. She's the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And you can find her at finalwordsproject.org. So Lisa, after your father's passing and you'd recorded some of the things that he had said, how did you go about collecting the words that other people had said?
Well, I began first by going, I was in in Berkeley in California. I went to school at UC Berkeley, and I right after my dad died, he was literally down the street from the university. I went there to see what other research had been done, to just find out more, and saw that there was really nothing done on the linguistics or language of the dying. And it was a long, slow process because it's a very sacred and private time. And most hospices and hospitals, rightly so, really have very strong boundaries about how you approach families of the dying and so forth. I mean, of course, and getting the transcripts of people's final words. So it took time, and it began with having conversations with people online, just getting the word out slowly. And then ultimately what happened is, as I did presentations and as I just had conversations with people, the word got out. And I guess the main source, well, there are several sources. As people in hospice knew I was doing this research, and as I interviewed them, the doors slowly opened for me to invite families and loved ones to write down transcripts. And also, at the time, a few months after my dad died, I took a workshop with Raymond Moody, and he's the person who wrote the book Life After Life in 1975, and he's the doctor who coined the term near-death experience.
Oh.
And yeah, and he's a wonderful human being. And he also has a PhD in philosophy, where he had a passion specifically for nonsense language. And so I took this workshop from him, and he started talking about his interest in final words. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is remarkable, because I, at that point, had become very, very intrigued and just started the process of collecting data and reading everything I could about end of life. And so he sort of invited me to work with him. And I did. I moved from California to Georgia. And so having the connection to Raymond really helped, because people knew who he was, and it led some credibility to my to the research. And so formally we founded the Final Words Project, and then a lot of the data was collected through the website. We have a tab where people can go in and share. And then I started going to conferences with him, and we just started getting the word out. And now we're up to about 2,000 utterances. And it's been wonderful since the book's been published, because as I've spoken with people like you and your listeners, I'm getting more and more data, which is just fantastic, so we can learn more.
Thank you. So when you say 2,000 utterances, how many different people is that from?
That's a really, really good question. It's really probably now, because I'm just doing it by I do it just by language sample. I think it's probably about 225 people. But a lot of the information too that I received were not in the data set that I'm talking about, but also more informally anecdotes from hospice professionals. So some of the information just came more from the observations and not the actual words said, but more, a hospice professional might say, yeah, I've noticed that a lot of my patients talk about transportation and taking a trip. And so that's not included in the data set, but that was included in part of informing my understanding of what happens in the language.
So just to clarify, Lisa, when you, obviously hospice workers are working with death and dying all the time, and they see probably hundreds of people every year that have passed on, so they would have more of a general view of the types of things people say. Now, this data set that you're talking about, are these loved ones of individuals?
Generally, so what I did is, as people heard about this, I would ask people, would you be willing to write down the words that you hear from your loved one? Would you be willing to write them down and share them? And, this was really tricky because, of course, in the very beginning, being a linguist, I was like, oh my gosh, I want to get a digital recorder, and put it by the bedsides of people as they're dying. And quickly I learned that for so many reasons, that was not the right thing to do. And I thought back to my own grandmother, who right before she died, she called me into her, you know, bedside. And she said, you know, Lisa, I want you to know that you were my favorite granddaughter or grandchild of all of them. You and I had so much in common. And so she'd shared, you know, this really, you know, it made me feel really good to know that. And it was a very private moment. And, you know, a moment like that, I'm glad that was never recorded, right? Because that was just a conversation between her and me. But then what happened is 6 months later, I was speaking to one of my cousins and he kind of said sheepishly to me, you know, Grandma told me that I was her favorite. Right? And then, of course, my other cousin, guess what? She looked and she smiled. She said, she told me that too. And that was so much a part of who my grandmother was. She made all of us feel favorite. But if I had a digital recorder at her bedside, she would have never had the glory or the joy of telling each of us, right, that we were her favorites. Or she may have felt self-conscious. So it became really clear to me early on that tape recording people's last words was really it was potentially a real invasion of privacy at a very, very, very sacred private time. So that's why I invited loved ones and family members to write down and share with me what they heard. And, you know, it's not the most scientific. I mean, I'm the first person to say that the research I did wasn't super. I did not do it through a university. And by anybody's standards, it's not super rigorous, formal research, but it was a first step in beginning to better understand final words. And between the transcripts that people shared with me, and many times it was just they just shared a few selected things, not everything. And between that and then interviewing hospice professionals and people in nursing in general and a few doctors, I got some, you know, I began to get some sense and overview of what the patterns are, but I really feel we're at the very beginning of this research. And I by no means feel that what we've done is exhaustive and gives the whole picture yet.
So Lisa, where do you see this research going? What is the future of the language of death and dying look like to you?
Well, you know, we did notice some very real patterns, and among the patterns that we studied is there's been a long, long, long tradition where people have this very funny relationship to nonsense, right? Sentences that don't make sense, like my dad saying, my modality is broken, or another sentence that he said, introductory offer, the store is closing. Like, what? that's nonsense, right? So one of the things that Raymond talked about a lot is that, you know, we have this very funny relationship to nonsensical language. On one hand, you know, Dr. Seuss or Alice in Wonderland, which is filled with nonsensical language, are, you know, these things are very, these authors, these books are very, very popular, have sold thousands of copies. So on one hand, we love nonsense, and yet there's been very little formal study of nonsense. And it's not unusual at the end of life to hear people to start speaking in what sounds like gibberish or nonsense, and no one has ever looked at those patterns and really saw what kinds of patterns of nonsense. And as a matter of fact, we don't really look at nonsense generally in a systematic way. And Raymond Moody says there's like a nonsense taboo. So one of the first things we really want to do is begin to look more systematically at what kind of nonsense appears in the language of end of life, Alzheimer's, everywhere. Begin to take nonsense more seriously, right? But what we saw at end of life, well, for example, Raymond, who loved nonsense as a philosophy student, when he was a doctor way back in late 60s, or a medical student, I mean, he would have patients who would die and then come back. And they would say things to him like, wow, when I was dead, you know, I never felt as alive as when I was dead. And that's nonsense, right? That's a nonsensical statement. Or they'd say, wow, when I was dead, I was floating out of my body and moving through a tunnel, and I saw this bright light. That was sheer nonsense in those days, you know, very much people like, this is nonsense. So as Raymond wrote down all these things people said that seemed like sheer nonsense based on what happened to them when they died and then came back from their death experience, when he wrote it all down, their nonsense actually fell into patterns. He noticed patterns. So in some ways, nonsense can really give us insight into things. So Raymond and I also looked at the end of life and the language and the nonsense that appears at end of life. And now what we're doing, of course, is looking at it systematically. And I know from people who work with the Alzheimer's patients or family members also, we're looking at ways to start looking at the nonsense of Alzheimer's and seeing what kind of patterns emerge. So part of where we hope this is going is that we begin to find categories of nonsense and the way nonsense may appear in different environments in people's lives at different times of life. And the other place that I hope this research goes is cross-linguistic. I've begun to hear from people around the world about their loved ones' final words. And I want to see, for example, at end of life, one of the things we found, and it's been written about before actually, is at end of life, people start talking about a trip they're taking. They start making reference to forms of transportation that are waiting for them or that they see or hear. And are we going to find that in France? Are we going to find that at the when people are dying in Spain? So part of the other direction I see, I hope this work will go, is looking at cross-linguistic. What are other people saying at the threshold?
Thank you, Lisa. And I'm wondering, when you talk about this nonsensical things that people say, I'm wondering if there's any similarities between sleep talking and death talking.
Yes. Matter of fact, I think there is. And first of all, we know that when people are dying, oftentimes they're very actively dreaming. And dreaming is a way that people, well, just like all throughout our lives, dreaming is a way that we make peace with or try to make sense of things that we're grappling with, right? So when people are dying, their dream life often is very much oriented towards trying to make peace with this, almost incomprehensible thing to the living that's dying, right? We have to face this almost unintelligible reality that life is over, at least life as we know it. And when we look at people's dreams, in many dreams, as people die, they dream about travel, they dream about trips. So then maybe it's not surprising also that their language begins to reflect this kind of dreamlike state. The other thing that happens when people are dying, their dreams often have people who have died before them in those dreams, and they see their loved ones in ways that are as clear as day in their dreams. And then people also, when they're waking and not dreaming but waking, report to us that they see loved ones who had passed before them near their bedside. They see oftentimes, let's see if I could have a good example for you here. Aha. Here's a few. He said just a few words. Hallelujah, my wife. He had a big smile on his face. And I don't remember him saying anything else after that. Here's another one. It was as if my dad were speaking to my mom, who had died 10 years earlier by phone, and I heard only his end of the telephone call. He was so excited and happy. It was hard to believe that it was just imagination. Something very real seemed to be going on. And what I've heard from people who do dream research of the dying is that dreaming of loved ones is very common. And from my final words is speaking to and with deceased loved ones is also really common, even when people are not in a dream state. So this the line is very much blurred between sleep talking and, you know, a wide awake speech, or what we think of as waking language. And that's one thing that happens when people are dying. It's almost as if they're living, not everyone, but many are kind of in dream time. And yet, then someone might emerge from this sort of dream time awareness to, oh, could you get me a glass of water, honey? You think, wow, what just happened, you know? So it would be easy. Like when I first started looking at this with my father, I could have just discounted it, like, oh gosh, it's probably morphine and he's got, you know, he's medicated, or just because he's sick, his language is all strange. But then he would come back and be lucid and know who I was, or even say, oh yeah, the angels, the angels are there in the corner of the room, where his language was actually very lucid. So it's this really interesting kind of mishmash of kind of dream language and then, more what we think of as real and lucid. I mean, and it varies a lot with people, but that's kind of a generalization.
Thank you. Well, right now we are speaking with Lisa Smart. She is the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And you can find her at finalwordsproject.org.
Hey, did you know?
More than 4,500 Canadians are waiting for an organ transplant right now.
Right now. 4,500.
People are dying.
And you could save a life.
90% of Canadians say they're willing to donate their organs.
But only a few are registered.
So what are you waiting for?
Get registered.
It's easy and it's free.
Leave a legacy.
Be a hero.
Save a life.
Find out how to register today. Go to kidney.ca.
Attention grad students, share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
We are speaking with Lisa Smart. She is the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And you can find her at finalwordsproject.org. And I'd imagine, especially if people have any loved ones who are in those final stages and are interested in taking part in the project, that would be a good place to contact you, right?
Yes, it'd be fabulous. They can either confidentially just submit stories or observations, and we just love to hear about the nonsense and unusual things people say so we can gain better understanding. And also, we have a lot of information on the website, and our hope is that some of that might help people as their loved ones are dying to better understand what they're seeing and hearing.
Thank you, Lisa. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you've mentioned the transportation idea as being very common. What are some of the other common themes that you've heard people tend to say?
People speak, as I mentioned, my father talking about the big art show. They oftentimes speak of some large event coming, and then that event is oftentimes part of something that really mattered to them in their lives. So let me give you some example. On the night my aunt died from lung cancer, she was clearly between two worlds. Her last words to me were when she asked me to bring her best dress and shoes to the hospital because she was getting ready to attend a grand ball that night and would be so happy to see me there. She died the next day.
Wow.
And so that, and the grand ball, the big dance, the big dinner, is really common. And I was surprised to hear also the big golf tournament. There are several people said something like, you know, Jack, who may have died before, earlier, Jack and so, you know, Jack, William, and Tom are at the big tournament and they need a fourth. And so people talk about the big tournament, the big dance. And then people oftentimes use the metaphors or symbols that are very close to who they are, as I mentioned a little bit before. So, for example, Jeffrey Holder was a dancer and a choreographer, and his son reported these last words, the very, very last words this gentleman spoke. Arms, 2, 3. Turn, 2, 3. Swing, 2, 3. Down, 2, 3. Another person described, Carol emailed me with an account of the last words of her father, or who is a roofing contractor. He would awaken and look over at me and smile so big, and he told me, they have all these kitchenettes over there. There were miles of them. And he was so happy because he told me he would help build them. So, you know, one way, so the metaphors, this gentleman who was a contractor was excited about the kitchenettes that were awaiting him, maybe on the other side or in his dream time. It's hard for me not to believe that it might actually be the other side. And then, so there's those metaphors that relate or those things that relate to a person's life. And then there's different types of nonsense. There's just straight gibberish where people are just making kind of like the sounds you might hear in an infant, just nonsense syllables. But what most of the samples I got were either linguistic nonsense, like, oh, sir, get the doll of roofing.
Hmm.
Or, yes, I'd like scrambled eggs, but where would you reappear? So you get that, but you get that kind of nonsense, and then you also get what I call situational nonsense, where the words make sense, but in the situation they don't. So, for example, mom is here with me now. Well, mom died 15 years ago, and what we know about this reality, that's nonsense, because, you know, but people are seeing, you know, this person, many people referred to seeing their mothers or others in the room with them. Or it's so beautiful here. It's so beautiful. People speak a lot about another landscape. One gentleman describes seeing trees and woods on the hospital wall and that there were two doors and he was trying to decide which door to go through. Again, in our idea of what this world is, that's considered nonsensical. Or one father said to his daughter, the white butterflies are coming out of your mouth and they're so beautiful. There's something I call prepositional nonsense, where prepositions are those little words that describe where people are, location, or in this case, location. So I gotta go down there. I have to go down. And that's from someone who's lying on their bed still, right? They're nowhere, right? I mean, they're talking about being going down, but they don't look up, right? They don't look like they're upwards. Or I've got to get down to earth, help me. I'm on the top now, moving on top. I'm crossing up. I've got to get off of this life. I'm dying. So people use these prepositions in really unusual ways that usually seem nonsensical to us, right? So anyway, this is just a sampling. Well, I'll give you one more type, hybrid nonsense, where one part of the sentence is grounded in this reality and the other part of the sentence seems to be grounded in an unseen or other reality. So please massage my feet, honey, so I can get down into the rabbit hole.
Hmm.
Get my camera. I need to take a picture of this. And we don't know what that this is. They left the ladders, but the ladders are too short. to go up there. This comes from a young 13-year-old. Please leave some money and baby clothes on my bed. I will need them in heaven when I have a baby. So you can see the language is very rich and very perplexing. And so some of the things I just read to you fall into the category of nonsense. And yet so many people, when they hear these words, feel like some kind of sense is being made or something is going on that's remarkable or unusual. One of the things my dad said to me, which again is nonsense, but was very touching, is he said, "Oh, Lisa, there is so much so in sorrow." Right? So much so in sorrow. Hmm. Again, it's a nonsensical statement, but what I heard from him is, there's so much grief in my sorrow. There's so much sorrow right now. So the language is very rich. It's not the language that we're accustomed to in our ordinary lives. And that's what is so compelling and intriguing to me.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, we are speaking with Lisa Smart. She is the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death.
Do you love the idea of empowering female youth through music creation and performance? Girls Rock Camp Vancouver is a 100% volunteer-driven nonprofit that promotes self-esteem and builds technical skills in female and non-binary youth ages 8 to 18. Help support this initiative by donating, volunteering, or attending their end-of-camp performance July 15th at the Rio Theater. If you're interested in being a camper or volunteering with Girls Rock Camp, visit girlsrockcampvancouver.ca.
Tune in every Thursday from 11 p.m. till midnight for Copy and Paste with your host, Tim, a.k.a. Autonomy, the very best in underground dance music.
Are You Aware Radio, alternate Thursday 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
We are speaking with Lisa Smart. She is the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And if you'd like to take part in the research that she's doing, you can contact her at finalwordsproject.org. There's so many things that I want to ask you, Lisa, and only so much time. So I'm just maybe for a moment we can touch on what kind of research you're wanting from people. So let's say their loved one died 10 years ago, but they clearly remember one or two things. Or is there anything specific that you're needing from people who want to participate?
No, we very, you know, really, this is the first time, as far as we know, this is the first time this data has been collected. And right now, we don't want to put any exclusions on it because we're still getting an overview of what people's experiences are. And, you know, I know I've heard from many people who had experiences 10 or 20 years ago, but because they were so powerful and the moments were so clear to them, and sometimes people actually wrote them down, that it's fine that those accounts are older, right? And so, yes, I would love those accounts. And there's really nothing that I would say we wouldn't want to hear about, because the more we hear, the more we can learn. And I don't think, I don't think we have the full picture. I think we've only just begun. So yes, anybody's account would be highly prized and valued and appreciated.
Beautiful. Again, that website is finalwordsproject.org. And you, Lisa, mentioned that you kind of do seem to believe that this may be evidence of the other side. But do you want to talk a little bit more about what you think might be happening, or what does it mean to you?
Wow. Yes, I think when I started this research, I was not I was not, you know, I was not one of those people who believed in an afterlife. You know, I didn't go into it that way at all. And I'm not too sure yet if it's definitely an afterlife. You know, it's not the way, you know, I don't think it's necessarily, you know, there's this traditional heaven and there's this person sitting on a throne with a big beard or anything. I mean, I don't know if it's that, but I also don't know that it's not that. I don't know enough yet. But what I do know is that, you know, people who are very close to dying, in many cases, their brains, you know, on if a doctor would tell you their brains are barely functional, you know, that there are people who have severe Alzheimer's or so forth, and on, you know, medically they should have no consciousness or awareness, right? I mean, if we're talking about the seat of consciousness in the brain, there should be little awareness. Or if, you know, or if people had no activity in their brains, how could they have such vivid dreams and so forth? So what you see at end of life, to me, in the language, are so many indications that there is something still going on, even as people are losing capacity in every way. So, for example, there's something called terminal lucidity, right? Oftentimes, right before someone dies, they'll have this very lucid window of time where even if they've been unresponsive for days, weeks, even months, they will have they'll just have this lucidity. They'll wake up, they'll look at people and be completely lucid. So there's one example of this. One person who is very credible, his mother had Alzheimer's and was very difficult to understand for several years. Then she had a coma. Her brain was, by all accounts from the doctors, there was just basically no brain left. And then 3 days before she died, she got up, she looked at her son and said, "Honey, I don't want to burden you with the finances. You know, I don't want you to be burdened. Three drawers down in my study are all the financial files you will need to make sense of my account and my estate when I die."
Wow.
And he was stunned. And then she went back into a coma. And I've heard, the first time you told me that story, to be honest, was a part of me was like, yeah, You know, I mean, and I knew this guy and I trusted him, but there was still like, oh, well, maybe you were just imagining things or something. But I've spoken to more people and I've heard several stories that are so similar. I mean, that one's a very dramatic case, but still of people, one woman was in a coma for several months. She opened up her eyes on Christmas Eve and knew it was Christmas Eve and said to her husband she wanted to give him a gift and so forth. But where did that awareness come from? And so that's just one of many indications to me as I was doing this research that there seems to be something much more powerful than just the capacities of our physical brains, and that powerful mystery, that consciousness, really seems to exist to me as people die. And the fact that there are visitors at people's bedside, or that my father talked about angels, my father talking about angels. I mean, this is a man, you know, who didn't believe in such a thing. So how was it he was seeing angels, and how was it that those angels knew that in 3 days he would be gone? So those are the kinds of things that I saw, and also what I learned from Raymond about near-death experiences and just how people, as they were dying, talked about leaving their bodies and crossing up and moving up. It seems so consistent with what we know about near-death experiences. It was really hard for me to believe that something, that there might be a spirit indeed, or something that changes its relationship to space and time in our final days.
It's fascinating. I mean, just from an evolutionary, like, not thinking about the afterlife, I'm wondering if maybe it has something, maybe that final burst of lucidity is our passing something on to the next generation to help with survival, you know?
That's like, beautiful.
Like the financial information, you know, like that probably took whatever energy was left in her body to communicate that.
That's a beautiful way to frame it and look at it. And in all the language samples that I collected during terminal lucidity, there was not one person who turned to their, you know, loved one and said, I just want to let you know, I've never told you that I've always thought your husband was a creep, you know, or, you know, something. If they're always loving words. And so you could map it that, you know, people are just trying to, you know, spiritually make peace before they go. But you could also look at it more evolutionarily in a way of, that those kinds of reconciliations and those kinds of words are going to ensure that people move on probably with more, you know, more heartily, for lack of a better way to put it. So I think that's one way of mapping what's going on in the end. And I'm totally open to it. I am open to it. And there are other things that I could say there that we know about shared death experiences and other kinds of things that happen to people at with their loved ones at end of life, where they really see kind of a smoke or a mist come out of their loved one's body as they're dying. I mean, there are other things that indicate something more transpersonal might be going on, but I don't feel it's my domain to be able to say yes or no to that. Does that make sense? All I know is what the data tells me. And I'll tell you this, I'm not afraid of dying the way I used to be. And just because I see that there seems to be something in the dying process that most people, you know, many of us, of course, are afraid of dying, but through the dying process, through the dreams and the visions of people who have died before us, or angels, or beautiful landscapes, it does seem that we are designed to come to peace with our final moments, and that many people, not all, but many people, you know, in a setting like hospice, of course, not after a tragic car accident or, you know, being murdered or something, but many people seem to leave with a sense of peace and I think your point's a good one, and it's also a really good way to frame the possibility of what's going on at the end.
Mm-hmm. But we may never know until we have that experience, I guess, for ourselves, then we'll find out.
yes.
And then, Lisa, we just have a few minutes left in the show. Again, we've been speaking with Lisa Smart. She is the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And again, if you want to get in touch with her and take part in this project, www.finalwordsproject.org is the website. And can we talk a little bit about the end of life communication, or the, you know, I will send you a sign that I'm there, I'll be watching over you. Like, what does that generally look like?
It's a good question. Well, when I started this research, I did not think that I was going to, you mean when people right after death or as they're dying? Just I want to make sure I answer your question how you want.
Well, I'm not sure, because I haven't really spoken with a lot of people who've been passing on. I have lost friends, and I haven't had any communication with them after death, but some people do believe that they're having communication with their loved ones after,
yes,
or they're leaving them little, you know, pennies, or so just in, yes, that whole realm, whether it's people passing on communicating this while they're living, or people's beliefs of communication they may have been having.
Yes. Well, when I did this research, I had not expected to look at after death communication. And yet many of the people who did write down final words or share accounts with me as their loved ones were dying would get back in touch with me a week to a month later and said, you're not going to believe this. After so-and-so died, I had some kind of communication from that person. And I heard this from people from a chemistry professor who was very skeptical about such things. And people get these communications in many ways. Things like one person described how her doorbell started ringing and wouldn't stop, and she couldn't get it to stop. And she had a friend over who happened to be a contractor, and he couldn't figure out what to do to stop the ringing bell. And it turned out one of her dearest friends, who she did not know had a very rare form of cancer, had passed away at just that time in Brazil.
Wow.
And it's very common where people reported to me things like lights going on and off. One woman described to me how her boyfriend, her former boyfriend, played in a band called Smoke. And right after he passed away, all the smoke detectors in her house, she had a couple of smoke detectors in her house, started going off and beeping. And this happened for a period of weeks, even though she, kept changing the battery and checking them. And people talk a lot about birds and butterflies. And my father, right after he died, I was, would pray and meditate in the morning, and it was just quiet time. And I started hearing poems from him. And I started writing those down. And a lot of people have reported, this automatic writing. And then again, I meditate in the morning because it gives me a sense of peace and quiet. But when I heard my father's voice after my dad died, and again, I've heard this from other people, I just felt like I'm going to suspend disbelief and let his words come through. And I've heard this from a lot of people of, when they just relaxed and let the words come through, oftentimes they were comforting. Now, is that just the function of our imagination in some kind of evolutionary way too, or a way to support those of us who are living? It could be that indeed. But I'd rather, there's comfort in it. So why not live with the comfort? You know what I mean? And embrace that. But there are so many ways that our loved ones seem to show up in these synchronicities. I mean, the language of spirit, one person told me who I interviewed, he calls it the language of spirit, is often highly connected to synchronicities in our life.
Hmm. Beautiful. Well, we are almost out of time. Again, we've been speaking with Lisa Smart. She's the author of Words at the Threshold. If you want to get in touch, her website is finalwordsproject.org. So, Lisa, is there anything you feel that you hasn't been said and needs to be added, or something that is really important that you want us all to remember about this?
Well, just that if anyone is sitting bedside with their loved ones and they're hearing language that frightens them or baffles them or confuses them, if it's possible, just do exactly what you had kind of mentioned earlier on the show. Just ask questions and be in conversation. And if it's possible, try not to be afraid. And from people who have engaged their loved ones in conversations about what they're seeing, it's pretty remarkable what they've heard. And it's many times very comforting in terms of hearing about other loved ones being in the room with them and so forth. So I would just say, keep your heart open. And if possible, try not be afraid when you hear unusual language. And write the words down, write things down, because later on it might give you some comfort and insight.
Yeah, even if you're not planning on taking part in the project, it's
something to... Yes. So those are a few things. And often, sometimes our loved ones don't speak to us. And I've heard from many people that when we're just sit quietly, that one woman who did research in comas said that people who survive comas say that they're much more aware than we think. So whenever we're in the presence of a loved one who's dying, speak kindly and lovingly, because there's a lot of research to indicate that they may hear us, even if it seems they don't.
Beautiful. I'm wondering, actually, that brings up a question, because my mother, when she passed away, all the times that I went to visit her, she was asleep. And I didn't know that, because when she first went into hospital, she was in a coma, and then she'd fallen into in and out of coma. So I didn't know that I could wake her up and speak with her. Mm-hmm. So that I only found this out after she passed. by her friends who had visited and would wake her up. So I went and I would speak with her, but she was sleeping. And so I kind of stopped going as often because I didn't feel like she knew I was there.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, of course she knew how much you loved her and she knew that and she felt that, but, so, you know, obviously please don't feel badly that you didn't spend more time with her. But we do know that, you know, again, 70% of people who survive comas say that they were aware for at least some part of the time. And also people reported kind of telepathic understanding and awareness when they were in comas. One woman was talking about how she knew the doctor was having an affair with the nurse and things like that. So, you know, people does seem are more aware than we may think. And, but it's hard, you know, it's hard sometimes to believe that and feel that when we see someone we love, you know, very unresponsive or seemingly unresponsive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm hoping that that your book and this conversation will help people who are dealing with this in their lives and dealing with the passing of a loved one, and hopefully it will encourage people to ask more questions and to be more curious.
Yes, absolutely. And so the book is Words at the Threshold, and I hope it's helpful or at least opens some doors into understanding death and dying and consciousness. So I hope it's helpful.
Beautiful. And Lisa, is there anything you want to add before we say goodbye?
No, except thank you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Again, we've been speaking with Lisa Smart. She's the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death, and that website, if you want to take part in the project, finalwordsproject.org. Thank you to Lisa for her time and for writing this book. And thank you for being with us and spending this hour with us today. I want to send you lots of love. Have a wonderful week. Be well. Namaste.
Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
After decades of decline, drowning fatalities have been rising dramatically in Canada since 2004. Most drowning victims had no intention of going in the water, and harmless situations can become dangerous quickly. This summer, if you're going out on the water, even if you're not planning on going in it, be water smart and be prepared. Here are some things you can do to reduce your risk of drowning. Learn to swim and swim to survive. If you can tread water for a minute, you can orient yourself, and if you can swim 50 meters in a pool, you'll most likely be able to swim to safety in open water. Most drowning fatalities occur within just 15 meters of safety. Wear a life jacket or personal flotation device. 80% of all boating deaths were people who were not wearing one. Take a marine safety course, and if you're going kayaking or canoeing, know how to get out of your craft if it flips over. Practice basic safety moves such as wet exits and self-rescues. Save the alcohol for dry land after you're done playing on the water. And never go out alone. For more information and more safety tips, go to lifesaving.bc.ca.
All right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it wrong. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay. Wait, hold on. Does this make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we... You're not even going to last. All right.
Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France, Montreal... What the f***?
It's a script. I couldn't even... What? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that, because even a fucking elf couldn't understand that, okay?
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR production department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
Whoa, 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 whoa. 4th Annual Picnic in the Park UNA Skate Jam is happening Friday, July 7th from 3 to 7 p.m. Come out for a relaxed and fun family-oriented skateboard competition. It's an open bingo game of skate. You could win swag from Skull Skates and other prizes. All skill levels are welcome. So come out with your friends and your mom and play a game of skate at the Picnic in the Park UNA Skate Jam.
Tune in every other Sunday from 3 to 4 p.m. for Blood on the Saddle with your host,